Ahoy hoy! Today's episode is going to try something a little bit different. If you haven't listened to the Spanish Civil War series episodes 1 and 2, you might want to pause this and come back a little bit later. If you don't mind jumping right in, or if you already know the basic gist of the war, feel free to carry on forward. I want to really, really thank Adam Patterson for doing me the favor of being on the show. He's got a lot of really great, interesting things to say. That was a wonderful conversation that we had. We were also chatting about this the week before we did the recording about how doing a full-on scripted episode of this podcast series, like an hour a month, is pretty unsustainable because, you know, I'm doing this on my own time. It's not a professional outfit, at least not yet. I was telling him that, you know, I think these discussion podcasts will be really interesting and a lot of fun, but, they are also a lot less work to do. He suggested that I come up with the title Stalin for Time. Get it? Anyway, Adam Patterson is an analyst of armed conflict who specializes in civil war, insurgency, and extremist movements. You can find his work at currentaffairs.org and his blog napalminthemorning.com. He currently focuses on sectarian violence in the Middle East. He joined me via Skype at the end of December to discuss anti-fascism, what separates Francoism from the full-on fascism of the Nazis, the evolution of terror bombing and militia tactics from the Spanish Civil War to modern times, and of course, what is the relevance of anti-fascist history in the upcoming age of Trump?
Word. So I think the first thing I wanted to just kind of jump into as our launching off spot, I think one of the things that I found really strange and intriguing going into this project was how very little sort of popular historical knowledge there seems to be on the Spanish Civil War. Like, There's a lot of aspects to that period that, you know, maybe we don't necessarily really know a lot about it, but we think we do. People have some frame of reference, you know, for the Holocaust and Nazi Germany, that sort of thing. They have a frame of reference for the European theater of World War II, some frame of reference even for things like Stalingrad, you know. You have plenty of movies about things like that, literature. Mm-hmm. And there is a decent amount of literature on the Spanish Civil War, but it doesn't seem to have the same sort of popular memory, at least in the United States. I think it's very different internationally. But I found that very strange considering how I think one of the kind of angles I've been going for in the series I'm doing right now is that it's sort of a preview of what you were going to see in the next couple of years, whether it's via the terror bombings, which are in much smaller scales, but you do see the beginning of that theory and practice and doctrine being developed in Madrid and in Guernica, or the use of anti-Semitism, which is, in the Spanish context, there's not that many Jews to, you know, pogrom per se, but you do sort of see the beginnings of, or not the beginnings, but you see a preview of how central anti-Semitism would become to the coming European war. And also the fact that throughout the war, and I haven't gotten into this in the podcast twice yet, but there is a feeling throughout the Civil War of knowing that there's probably going to be a general war in Europe pretty soon. And that impacted the political and military decisions of the Republic, who were constantly thinking, oh, any time now. At some point, Hitler's going to overreach, and the Allies are going to get involved. And, you know, there's no way they're going to compromise on Czechoslovakia. Things like that.
Yeah, it's, the Spanish Civil War was an eccentric little war compared to what we saw with sort of the fabled and sort of heavily studied conflagration across the sort of entire European continent. And it's interesting, too, because, and I think sort of history can oftentimes be colored by, especially in the Anglophone world, by the diplomatic precedents. Because the Spanish Civil War was this, as sort of broadly speaking, the standoff between the Falangists and the sort of Christian fascists, or rather Catholic fascists, versus the more leftist populist and frankly, sort of USSR-backed sort of broader rebel configuration, whereas the Anglo-American sphere kept a sort of stance of pretty resolute neutrality. Mm-hmm. And sort of when you look at America and in England, there's a lot of romanticization and sort of historical sort of heroic memory regarding World War II, mm-hmm. in which sort of our nations were active participants. But sort of considering the Spanish Civil War was so diplomatically peripheral in a lot of ways, it seems to be sort of treated with lesser significance, rightfully or wrongfully, compared to the sort of massive sort of cross-continental flare-up that happened when, you know, Hitler decided to get land grabby.
Yeah, it's interesting because certainly in its time, that was very true, in that one of the last things that Roosevelt wanted to be dealing with was the Spanish Civil War. He wanted to avoid it at all costs. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, much to his discredit. And yet, public opinion was, I mean, I don't know if I would say it was the majority, but a significant amount of popular support existed in the United States for the Republicans and even for the revolutionary wing of that coalition. And yet, it seems that seems to have disappeared very, very quickly. I think partially probably because Franco was pretty smart about picking and choosing his battles and pretty intelligently decided to stay out of World War II. I am sure much to Hitler's chagrin. And very, very quickly figured out, you know what, this... So, like, one of the interesting things I found in going into this is the realization that I do think that the war was certainly a war against fascism. Mm-hmm. And yet, Franco himself was not at all ideologically fascist. He was really big into Catholic authoritarianism, certainly.
Yeah.
But anti-communism, but... the fascism side of things seemed to have been very much a matter of convenience, a flavor of the week almost, where for that period he realized, like, okay, if I want to win this particular match against the Republicans and the communists and whatever, it would be in my interest to be buddy-buddy to Hitler and Mussolini. But then once you have World War II come along, he's like, all right, guys, yo, we're tired, we're exhausted, we're busy executing all these people right now, so, like, we're gonna have to stay out of this one. And then, of course, you have the Nazis and the fascism being defeated and the Cold War beginning, and then he figures out, aha, oh, I know how I can come out on top in this new political realignment. I'm going to passionately advocate and rebrand myself as an anti-communist sort of stronghold. And that seems to be a major change in the way American memory holds Franco in the Spanish Civil War, where all of a sudden, you know, he kind of joins that long list of, like, your Pinochets and your Rios Montt and other folks like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Spanish Civil War seems, in terms of our historical recollection, been buried under a lot of really strange layers. And you're absolutely correct about that. Sort of when the Axis powers were defeated in World War II, there was this massive sort of potential power vacuum, and it sort of shook out along the lines of sort of the what we refer to as the NATO West, or who would refer to themselves as the NATO West, versus sort of the USSR bloc. And when all sorts of smaller sort of pieces were reshuffling themselves, Franco was able, as you said, was canny enough to say, look, I am an anti-communist. I am someone who, even if you think I'm a distasteful human being, even if, you know, I have done sort of atrocious things in the past, you can trust that I will not be your immediate antagonist, mm-hmm. which was shrewd, you know, and also, again, puts the Spanish Civil War in a very complex place because, you know, you go from the position of this broad sympathy – for the leftist sort of factions in the Spanish Civil War, to them being, of course, pretty brutally defeated and treated pretty horribly in the aftermath, to Franco all of a sudden turn around and say, look, hey, you can trust me. I'm not a pinko. And that's sort of...
I think one of the things that made him, I don't want to say brilliant, but, you know, certainly a survivor and politically fairly very savvy, is he was decidedly non-ideological in a period of fierce ideology and was extremely good at playing off those squabbles in, like, either between ideology or within ideology to be like, all right, what does it make the most sense to be right now? And the through line of it all is rigid authoritarianism and brutality, which, you know, is a very effective political tool in a period like the 30s, 40s, and so on.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, too. I mean, if you look at, if you look at sort of the way the Nazis posture themselves, there are all sorts of everything from sort of their bizarre sort of racial pseudoscience to all sorts of various aspects of sort of really arcane political doctrine. They were, as you mentioned, fiercely ideological. And Franco, of course, was a far right authoritarian who sort of favored sort of old reactionary systems like sort of the right wing of the Catholic Church in Spain, which made him a useful ally of convenience, but also made him sort of more malleable and sort of self-malleable, because it's sort of a key aspect of resilience during the heavy fluctuations of the 30s, 40s, and 50s is the ability to adapt in a way that you sort of allows you to step out of range, as it were. And it sort of, past a certain point in terms of both diplomacy and ideology and military doctrine, rigidity and an obsessive focus on implementing ideology through strategy can be the self-destruction of a lot of empires, and it's especially sort of fascistic entities. Like if you look back on, we mentioned a little bit earlier, Stalingrad.
Yeah.
Stalingrad was effectively the graveyard of the Wehrmacht, or at least the beginning of the end of the sort of the Nazi war machine. And it was all sort of heavily built upon this sort of the push into Russia was built upon this anti-Slavic sentiment that the German or the quote unquote Aryan sort of race must have dominion over all of Europe, including places outside of Germany's historical confines. And put into military practice, that meant this basically suicidal march into Russia in the midst of winter. You know, and it's sort of that rigid, obsessive focus on ideology and practice that proved to be many entities' Achilles heel. Whereas for the sort of some more smaller peripheral entities that were not so obsessive about their sort of, again, ideology and practice tended to persist. And that seemed to be Franco's, and this is a weird way of putting it, kind of his gift to himself, as it were.
It's interesting because I definitely, reading into Franco, and Franco is an individual, someone who I've not delved into as deeply or even read. He's not been the focus because, you know, I feel like this podcast is a little bit more about like the movements, so to speak, than it is about, like, you know, the great man history sort of thing. But something I do find very odd about it is that I do find certain things not sympathetic, but almost admirable about him from a very, like, real politic point of view in terms of just the man being very impressive as a political leader. Especially considering that he was a man who didn't seem to have very strict politics so much as he just was like, you know what, there's something very general-like about him, I guess you could say, where he's like, all right, I have a mission, and I'm going to accomplish it, and I have some theories and ideas about how to make that happen, but at the end of the day, fairly apolitical. Which is a weird thing to say about someone who led a, I would say, like, right on the edge of proto and outright fascist regime.
Well, it's interesting, too, in terms of power consolidation, because my sort of my journeyman understanding of Spanish history around that time is that what Franco did successfully is he only purged the left. He only persecuted the left. What Hitler sort of did, if you look at sort of the Night of the Long Knives and the various sort of internal squabbles of the Nazi Party, is that Hitler was, again, heavily and obsessively ideological, as were folks like Reinhard Heydrich. And there was a focus on thinning one's own ranks Franco seemed to consolidate lots of otherwise disparate factions on the Spanish front.
Yes. I think there are some rumors and theories that I saw in the reading I did about whether or not Mola and Sanjurjo untimely deaths were truly an accident. I'm inclined to think that they probably were truly an accident, certainly with Sanjurjo. It sounds by all accounts, it sounds like the dude really did just, like, bring too many clothes or luggage things and wound up learning the hard way, while you should really listen to your pilot when he says, "Yo, dog, we have too much weight. We should not take this flight." But and generally speaking, I think it's absolutely correct that I see very little infighting and very little paranoia within the nationalist side. And, you know, I think oftentimes you do have historical contexts where you do have legitimate concerns about your fifth column, so to speak. But Franco seems to have not been so much concerned with that as he was just very cleverly uniting or coercively combining and conjoining these different factions. I mean, I think one of the most convenient historical events was the fact that, and I'm blanking out on his first name, but the son of Primo de Rivera, the dictator in the 1920s, who became the founder and the leader of the Falangist movement, deeply ideological, very charismatic, extremely competent. By the beginning of the fighting in the Civil War, as it begins in earnest, he's in a Republican prison, and he's executed by the end of 1936. And his successor is someone who just does not have the same competence or charisma, who just isn't able to pose the same challenge to Franco. And Franco basically at that point is like, okay, I'm not going to try to... this is something I haven't, once again, have not delved into nearly as much as I probably should, but the Falangist movement... was actually quite anti-capitalist and revolutionary, although also, you know, still very, very right-wing in many ways. And I think, as from what I've been reading, it seems like in another context, they could have very much been a much more formidable part of the nationalist political movement. And there's a possibility that in another alternate universe where Primo de Rivera hadn't been captured so early on and been more of a rival to Franco, that they could have maintained the more militant, radical, sort of right-wing revolutionary character, which they pretty much lost once Franco wound up taking over, merging it with the other parties, and then flooding its ranks with new members who were not so much into answering the land problem. Because I do think that that is something that, of all the different nationalist factions, the Falangist seems to be the only ones who actually were concerned with the question of land and the lack of access to land. And I feel like that could have been something that in another context could have really thrown a monkey wrench in the just pure traditionalist nature of the Franco. The Francoists and the Franco ally people in there. It isn't the way it turned out, but it is very interesting to see that, Franco was really, really good, but also very fortunate as far as what the moves he had to play.
Yeah, I mean, some people just get lucky. And, you know, there's a sort of, if you look at the way hierarchies shake out in organizations, whether they're militant or sort of small insurgencies or broad political movements, the tendency for the organization to shift radically when particular charismatic figures are eliminated or deposed is quite impressive. And it's interesting, too, if you look at it, it's possible that had the Falangists sustained power or had there been a rivalry and Franco somehow been either a co-ruler, which is unlikely in a right-wing hierarchy like that, or had been deposed and the Falangists had become the ideological center, it's possible they could have been more Nazi-friendly. And it's possible they could have also been, as a result, more brittle and less successful. Because my broad understanding of the Falangists is that there was a sort of hefty dose or undercurrent of anti-Semitism and sort of if you look at a lot of third way sort of politics or sort of right wing anti-capitalism, the centerpiece hinges on saying that, yes, you, of course, are suffering. You, the sort of the common folk, are suffering under sort of a lack of access to land or capital or resources. But the consequence is not, you know, economic abuses by sort of on a systemic level. It's a consequence of X, Y, or Z marginalized ethnic group. And it's a really strange streak that can pop up across sort of similar. I mean, this is, of course, I'm going to get contemporary. But if you look at even in a very novice, strange way, when Trump says, you know, to folks in the Rust Belt that you can blame Latinos for being out of work, it's sort of a similar strange kind of permutation that sort of it bases upon a manufactured ethnic antagonism. Mm-hmm. Whereas, and which again can lead to a sort of strange obsessiveness. I mean, if you look at the, and this is a horrible way of rendering it, but the Nazi persecution of the Romani and the Jews in Europe was a massive waste of resources in addition to being an unspeakable humanitarian crime. And the fact that Franco did not seem to focus as extensively or at all on sort of similar ethnic persecutions meant that it kept his sort of coalition less distracted and more focused sort of singularly on the retention of power.
It's interesting. That is a fascinating and deeply disturbing point that well, I'll have to stew over on that one. Good God. I think it's interesting to consider the possibility to stay on this sort of vein of the pragmatist version of right-wing authoritarianism and the more ideological is the possibility of had the coup been immediately successful in July 1936, is it possible that you have the junta take over, the republic is just straight up quashed early on, the left purged and murdered? Would you then possibly have had a situation where the Falangists were, you know, you still have Primo de Rivera, who probably would have survived had the coup succeeded immediately, and the other factions still having independence, still having their political bases independent, still having their own militias, and then looking at this Spain that is not yet devastated or has not been devastated at all, that could have descended into not a right-wing civil war per se, but into a little bit more of an unstable period where maybe later down the line, once the European war began, would there have been a scenario where Hitler would be like, oh, this jerk, this junta possibly headed by Franco or somebody else, isn't really pulling his weight. Maybe I'm going to start sending my, like, support over the Falangists and, you know, such things like that. I mean, this is just complete speculation based on, like, really not a whole lot of knowledge that would be relevant. But I don't know, do you, in your estimation, do you think that that is something that could have been a reasonable possibility?
Oh, I think that's a distinct possibility. And in fact, I think that's, if we're talking alternate histories, probably the most feasible option of what would happen, assuming had the Falangist solidified power in Spain, not immediately descended into armed conflict internally. It's possible there could have been a really tense detente between the two with sporadic explosions of guerrilla violence, but nothing like the descent into full-scale civil war. And then as sort of the European conflict rage on, Spain could have been sucked into the vortex of Nazism, and Hitler could have basically said, look, you've got to deal with the malcontents on your doorstep. You've got to deal with the potential anti-fascists. And he could have either propped up, because if I understand, the Nazis provided some support to the right-wing faction in the Civil War. They did, for example, I think, provide auxiliary support during the horrific bombing of Guernica, but it was not sort of a full-scale dedication of military force. It's likely it would have been more pointed and direct had the Spanish Civil War sort of spilled over into the 40s, or not really blown up into the 40s. It's also possible, as long as we're talking alternate histories, that that would have resulted in the United States supporting the liberal or left-wing factions more aggressively rather than being distant and neutral, and that Spanish in the aftermath could have been sort of a more either socialist or sort of liberal capitalist entity, that it could have been entirely possible that the Anglo-American sphere propped up the rebels, and considering who won the Civil War, or excuse me, not the Civil War, World War II, it's possible that Franco and sort of right-wing Spain would have immediately gone to the proverbial ash bin of history.
Hmm, indeed. So I want to make sure we keep moving along here so we can cover some of the other interesting angles on this. To kind of bring it back to Stalingrad.
Let's do this.
Perhaps a little indirectly. I think one of the interesting things that also that I came across and had a lot of thinking about in this history is the role of the communists. I think I like to complicate things and not be too simplistic to the best of my self-critical abilities. And I found the question of what was the role of the Soviet Union, what was the role of the Spanish Communist Party, very fascinating and a hell of a lot of emotional and intellectual reflection is required in that. At the same time, they were immensely reactionary in certain respects. But at the same time, they could not have possibly fought as long as they could against the Nazis and the nationalists and the fascists without the aid of the Soviet Union. And in addition to that, the other angle on that, I to be more specific, was the International Brigades, unbelievably brave and just courageous in the conditions that they went through, not even having the support of, like, you know, the possibility that after the fighting was over that, you know, they might have, like, a GI Bill or even, like, a modest pension. But straight up, there's just nothing to gain in joining them. But then to see the history and see how many examples there were of them just being ordered into these straight up suicidal attacks, you know, attacking, you know, fixed positions without any air or any artillery or any sort of armor support against an enemy that has all of those, or at least a few of those things on multiple occasions. And, you know, it makes me think very much of Stalingrad at a lot of moments where you have the same sort of doctrine thinking of, like, all right, we don't have the same resources as the other guy, and we're under a pretty intense siege, and failure is not an option, so we might as well just send people to their deaths in a way that seems almost brutal and inhumane and unconscionable. And yet, they could not have possibly lasted that long without, in my opinion, a certain level of disregard for life. What do you think about that? You're the war guy. Tell me what you think.
Okay, it's a fascinating question because one of the under-remarked upon, even in sort of intelligent publications that address war and conflict, one of the under-remarked upon aspects is social organization and human psychology in combat. Because if you look at the performance, especially of small-scale guerrilla forces that lack heavy arms or even sort of sincere and heavy state support, the most powerful weapon they can wield is discipline and a lack of fear of death. And I don't mean lack of fear of death in this sort of chest thumping, sort of quasi suicidal idiocy. Let's run into battle. I mean this sort of stoic understanding that they might not make it, and therefore not to lose combat focus. And this is of course because my wheelhouse is contemporary Syria, especially the sort of eastern anti-ISIS front between broadly defined the jihadis of Islamic State and the Kurdish and Kurdish-led forces, and. Sort of is speaking of an analog to Stalingrad, the siege of Kobani in 2014 through the beginning of 2015 is, I think, a pretty key example of how a severely outnumbered and underarmed force wins. And it really comes down to a combination of, again, a lack of fear of death, exceptional esprit de corps combined with the understanding that, you know, you might fall and that this is to be expected in war, and a just raw ability to keep fighting. And if you have a force that relies heavily on tactics and organization, even if they only have small arms and they lack heavy artillery or air support, they can potentially wear out a force that lacks that level of discipline. I mean, in the case of Kobani, rather, which has been referred to as sort of a Syrian Stalingrad, the Kurds won, on that account, especially mm-hmm. when there was auxiliary air support. And in the case of the Spanish Civil War, even though the sort of the Republican and sort of left-wing factions were eventually defeated, they lasted longer. And it does come down to sort of the key aspect of organization and morale and psychology in prolonging a conflict that among a less German force might collapse more quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, the Spanish Republican fighters, if there's one thing they did not lack, it was a fighting spirit. And mm-hmm. it certainly eroded over time. I think demoralization, there was no way they were not going to experience it, considering how little support they were getting. Mm-hmm. But you do, like, see plenty of examples of them, these, you know, militias with antiquated weapons that, you know, don't even take the same ammunition. I think one of the most fascinating things I read about was, you know, people who were getting assigned arms, rifles that had been captured by Russia in, like, the Crimean War and things yeah. like that. And, yeah. you know, they were taking ammunition that hadn't been manufactured in decades from, like, multiple different countries.
Yeah.
And yet managing to hold off and to push back mm-hmm. and multiple assaults by the nationalists. To bring it back to the Kobani example, I remember one of the more iconic images I remember watching the videos and the coverage coming in during the siege was there was like a video clip I remember of an ISIS tank that they had acquired in Iraq probably yes. during the fall of Mosul. And you had all these YPG, YPJ fighters just tooling on them. Because, like, yeah. this tank was completely all by itself, no infantry support. And, like, it just didn't have a goddamn chance in the world. And these YPG, YPJ fighters, they eventually destroyed it. But you could tell that they weren't in any particular danger at that point. Because these fools didn't know what the hell they were doing. Who were coming in there. Like you were saying, like, the difference between the lack of fear of death. On the one hand, on one side, you have people who accept that they might not survive and doesn't mm-hmm. distract them. On the other hand, you have a bunch of yahoos who aren't afraid of death, but at the same time also seem to be afraid of a competent strategy and learning how to use a tank and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's something I can bring up, speaking about the example of tanks and sort of the way those mm-hmm. tend to play out in warfare. The example, I mean, I've seen the video. In fact, I've seen multiple videos of ISIS rolling sort of blindly into Kurdish territory or alleyways in Kobani with tanks they'd acquired from, you know, Cassius America left behind in Mosul, and being shadowed by Kurdish fighters and sort of living under this weird presumption, these ISIS fighters, that they're protected by armor and being hit. Like a single RPG shot barrels down the street from some, you know, 22-year-old Kurdish kid hiding behind a barricade. And it's the end of the story. It's also, I mean, it's too, and this gets to sort of an aspect of how lightly armed guerrilla forces are typically defeated or are attempted to be defeated. And they typically use just heavy shocks of firepower, whether artillery or air power or both, if they can't defeat them on the ground, because this sort of ties me to another sort of heavy aspect of siege warfare, which was the siege of Grozny mm-hmm. in Chechnya, mm-hmm. when Russia attempted to run through it in the sort of Chechen civil wars. And the first time, and I can't remember if this occurred in the first or second Chechen civil war, they happened within a very short span of time in the 90s. I think it might have been Yeltsin attempted to send in an entire, basically lightly unaccompanied tank brigade into the heavily shelled ruins of Grozny, Chechnya, which is the capital of Chechnya. And the Chechen fighters were overwhelmingly young guerrilla fighters and very lightly armed. And all they had, similar to the Kurds and similar to the Spanish Republican fighters, is light arms and in some cases small explosives. Mm-hmm. And what happened in Grozny is the sort of the Russian National Army tanks would go through these very narrow sort of post-Soviet streets that are sort of, again, narrow roadways, lots of very tall, indistinct concrete buildings. and you would have these tanks rolling slowly through these confined streets, and these Chechen rebel fighters just ducking in and out of buildings, these heavy concrete structures, and for lack of a better word, zapping these tanks with RPGs. And the Russians suffered just excruciating losses. And that's sort of an example of how a poorly managed strategic element, especially an attempted deployment of heavy firepower, can be counteracted by flexibility and sort of the discipline of a smaller force. And the sort of the negative consequence of that, though, of course, is that the recourse is that oftentimes the opposing enemy or the opposing force will just try heavy air power, for example, or just bring in the heaviest weapons, which it sounds like became a relatively common tactic as the Spanish Civil War progresses. I think the
Absolutely.
Nationalist side made heavier use of air power, which mm-hmm. cannot be shot down easily, if at all, and sort of cannot be engaged in sort of a firefight on the ground.
That is exactly what happened, pretty much. It's also very – reading that history can be very frustrating sometimes too, because to bring it back to the question of fighting spirit and competence mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing, the Nationalist Army was not necessarily the best army. They had elite units within it, such as the Army of Africa – which Franco yeah. had command over. But you also had the Metropolitan Army, who were not particularly well-trained, not particularly modern, didn't really have the best supplies, and made up the bulk of the army at yeah. the time. And to imagine what would have happened had you had a situation where the Nazis were unable to, or unwilling, to come to the aid, or the Italian fascists, to the nationalists, would you have possibly, I mean, obviously, we'll get to this later, comparisons between Syria and Spanish Civil War don't always work, and I think this might yeah. be one of them, but the sort of situation where, like, you have a very small number of elite, hardened, veteran, well-supplied soldiers, but then you have the majority of, like, the Falangas militias and the Carlist militias who, as far as I know, I don't read about them being particularly competent militarily, not incompetent per se, but I don't really see them as being a military force to be reckoned with so much as yeah. they were just deeply ideological and very fond of committing massacres and killing leftists and what have you. To a situation where you could have been like, all right, let's say we have a Carlist tank rolling into Madrid one day, surrounded by a bunch of anarchist militiamen who are just kind of like tooling on it, and then all of a sudden, you know, well, I don't think they had RPGs back then, but, you know, finding some yeah. way to take it down. And, you know, it's the only way that the Nazis could have transported the Army of Africa to Spain in the first place was oil from the United States, which is, and that's the thing that I think is the through line for me between the Spanish Civil War and greater anti-fascist and fascist history is, yeah, the West eventually did participate and contribute greatly to the defeat of fascism. I also, that's not the best use of the term, the West, so I apologize, that was sloppy of me. But you know what I mean, the liberal democracies.
Yeah. The NATO.
But leading up to that period, they missed so many opportunities. They basically straight up turned a blind eye. Roosevelt knew that Torkild Reber was selling or leasing at almost little to no interest all this oil, that there is no way in hell, I'm convinced, no way in hell the Nationalists could have won without American oil or trucks from Ford or all these other American companies that were willing to sell cheap things to the Nationalists. I think this actually – let me transition here to the question of today. I wasn't necessarily hoping for the series to be so contemporary. I think certainly over the last year we've seen, for well over a decade and a half, 2 decades, we've seen that proto-fascist movements, right-wing extremists have been experiencing a little bit of growth, gradual, slow but steady, and then to see the last year or two just how quickly it's really begun to hit get to a head. And I guess the open-ended question I have is what is it that we can learn from the past? Obviously, things are very different. You can't, you know, carbon copy the lessons and apply them to the future. But just, you know, what lessons can we take from the Spanish Civil War in Trump's America as it approaches rapidly?
The biggest lesson is that if there is sort of a dissent in the Civil War, the left needs to unify from the ground up. I mean other lessons. Yeah. But I think sort of if you look at, I mean, this is a broad and very complicated question, because I know a couple of very smart people, including one of my current professors, who makes the argument that what we are seeing is a sort of shadow parallel of the early 1900s. And there might be some sort of analogs, but I'm not entirely sure how concrete they are for along various parameters. But I think one of the, if you look at the rise of fascist movements, is they tend to emerge in the vacuum created or left behind by liberal democracies, especially sort of liberal democracies that allow sort of various forms of unaddressed social insecurity. It's, again, this is, you know, if you look at how various sort of proto-fascistic or at least authoritarian right figures address the very real scarcity and poverty and destitution that has been left in the wake of the growing global wealth gap, they will typically say that, you know, not only is it the standing establishment that is your enemy, but it's various shadowy, ostensible outsiders, whether they be ethnic or religious outsiders. And that is very easy to exploit for people who are opportunistic and cruel and cynical, to say that, you know, it's the Mexicans flooding over the border, or in Putinist Russia, there is, it's, what's interesting about Putin too, is that people tend not to, especially in the American press, really understand that Putin is, has taken on the mantle of being a white Russian Christian identity figure in an interesting sort of way. He, plays heavily off of the fear internal to Russia that Russia will become, or at least one day become, a Muslim majority country. In fact, I think if I've studied these statistical projections correctly, there is sort of a projection that by, I think, in the 2030s or the 2040s, the majority or near majority of Russians of military age will have been born to Muslim parents, which, if you think about sort of the rhetoric and the attitude coming out of Moscow, especially internal, I'm not talking about sort of a outward sort of diplomatic posturing. I mean, sort of the way in which Putin speaks about sort of the, and those close to him speak about the truth and necessity of sort of Orthodox Christian and light-skinned Russia is terrifying to consider, that, you know, that you could have a religion that has historically been a minority or seen as alien to Russia becoming popular, and therefore those and this is one of the places where I think the parallel is not as neat with the earlier 1900s, is that we're seeing massive demographic shift in sort of the in the either vaguely defined European or sort of post-colonial European countries in America, I mean, or in North America, Canada, but especially the United States. This, you have broad anxiety, you have sort of leaders who strike an authoritarian pose saying that I understand your anxieties and that only myself can fix it, and your anxieties are also the result of some potential outside group I can demonize and use as a counter engine in my ideological, you know, self-propelling up the ranks. Because Trump is oddly ideologically flexible, but the most consistent posture of his is one in which he says that I alone am your protector, and that the world is a frightening and unstable place. And he continually reinforces that in the pursuit of saying that only he can make America great or make America safe. And that's actually a very boilerplate and typical stance of right-wing wannabe authoritarians. You take any combination of sort of a changing and complex ethnographic landscape with sort of institution left in the wake of sort of the neoliberal order, and that's kind of what emerges.
I was going to say, I find it fascinating and almost deeply troubling how similar your description just then of Donald Trump was to Francisco Franco in a lot of ways, as far as being deeply ideologically flexible, and this whole like the world is a scary place and I alone can protect you, which is more or less his message, was more or less what he was all about. I think, first of all, I find the point about Russia demographically likely to have its youth be majority of Muslim parents to be fascinating. That is something I did not know. It's funny because you would almost think that the way you hear American politicians, Trump himself and others talk about, you would think that was the situation here, even though it's not even close to that. No, and yet, I feel the discourse in the United States about the Russians does not put very much emphasis. You would almost not even know there were any Muslim people living in the Russian Federation. If you listen to rhetoric, it's not even on anybody's radar, generally, unless you're actually reading people who know Russia in some level of depth.
I was just going to say, it's very interesting because America's understanding of Russia is so heavily fixated on the memory of the USSR.
Yes.
That it's hard for commentators to realize that Putin's caste, as can best be described as an analog to the American understanding of politics, is not far left or Stalinist. It's right wing.
Indeed.
Or at least it's right wing and nationalist.
Mm-hmm.
And especially based, because it's interesting if you look at the way there's a very heavy attempt to diminish the impact of religion as a judge of both the rightness or wrongness of one's ethnic belonging in the Soviet era. It was radically anti-clerical, and also sort of pushed that into sort of surrounding places that were not traditionally majority Orthodox Christian, like Chechnya as well, which has been Sunni Muslim for a few centuries. And if you look contemporarily, it's been a revival in sort of Putin posturing himself as the savior and protector of Christian values. And it's sort of interesting too. It's also why I think Americans scratch their heads at the sort of rhetoric coming out from Russia and from Putin's inner circle, where there's this attempt to cast people who are queer as sexual deviants and pedophiles. And we say, like, wait a second, Mike Pence isn't running Russia. Like, what's going on here? but of course, it does fall into this sort of very sort of authoritarian, sort of Christian adjacent, sort of, I am the protector of the purity of Russian society.
So, did you just open a cracker or something? What was that noise?
I'm chewing on like a granola bar.
Oh, okay, cool. I think that should be part of the make that part of our thing. Chewing on loud things.
If you have a soundboard, you can make like me chewing on something, one of the sounds.
Like a carrot or something like that. We were talking about anti-clericalism. That's how you made me think of this. That is one of the major features of the Spanish Civil War and the history leading up to it was the immense power of the Catholic Church. Very, very negative in a lot of ways. And the intense desire of not just the revolutionaries, but even the liberals and some of the moderate socialists to rid Spain of the Catholic Church's power and control. And one of the things that reading the histories, and they'll put varying levels of emphasis on this depending on their biases and perspectives, is the anti-clerical violence. Before the war, it's mostly property destruction, burning convents, churches, that sort of thing. And then during the war itself, it ends up escalating into straight up execution of clergy. I think the number that I came across was about 5,000-7,000 clergy members being executed by the Republic. Although we should also remember that the Nationalists killed some too. The emphasis that the
it's interesting too.
Go for it.
Oh, I was going to say it's interesting, sort of, if you look at the relationship of the Catholic Church to fascist movements, and of course, it's in no way universal. Sort of the amount of clergy in Europe, sort of over the World War II and pre-World War II periods, spans a whole complex space of humanity. There were Catholic clergy in Eastern Europe who did aid in the hiding of Jews and Jewish children, for example. But the Catholic Church oftentimes found allies in the more right-wing elements or fascist elements.
Yes.
In Spain and Italy, which is not to say that, you know, and this is a very crude brush I'm painting with here, not to say there were not fascist sympathizers in the majority Protestant countries, namely throughout, you know, the non-Irish UK and Scandinavia and then the Netherlands. But, like, even if you look at some sort of Catholic intellectuals, they made the horrible fallacy, like Evelyn Waugh in England, mm-hmm. who was both a Christian or a Catholic reactionary and had weird moments of fascist sympathy. And I think it comes down to not necessarily a religious thing as much as a traditionalist and hierarchical thing. And that's how I think, especially in Spain, the Catholic Church local to Spain found it easier to partner with the fascists and oftentimes found themselves targeted quite brutally by the left faction, is that there was a hierarchical authoritarian traditionalist strain that made them natural allies of convenience or coincidence to phalangists, mm-hmm, or absolutely. Even sort of more quasi-secular types like Franco.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Don't hesitate to criticize the church around here. I did receive the first three sacraments, so, you know, I feel like that gave me a little legitimacy here. But yeah, no, it's my own experience reading, and you know, I'm familiar with some of the right-wing authoritarian political situations in Latin America in the 20th century, where you do definitely see the tie between Catholic oriented leaders and regimes who then also adopt sympathy or some elements from European fascism. So it's definitely a thing. And one of the things that I found very interesting is, and upsetting, to be honest with you, is the American coverage, as well as British and some of the other liberal republics, whose media put so much emphasis on the anti-clerical violence while straight up omitting or even apologizing for the right-wing violence, some of which was even committed by the Catholic Church. And myself, yeah. You know, I'm the kind of person who's I'm anti-religious violence as much as the next guy, or anti-violence against people based off of religion as the next guy. But when I look at the history of the Spanish Civil War, it's not like other examples where you have, like, you know, Hindus and Muslims slaughtering each other periodically, you know, things like that. It's not sectarian. It is more of a religion versus secularist kind of conflict, which is not to say that killing is not still a very intense and violent and upsetting thing, but it just does not have that same sort of clear cut, like, oh no, this is awful and it has to stop. For example, burning a church, I just don't see it as the equivalent to, as executing people. And when you get to the point where you do have Catholic priests being executed, it's obviously the kind of thing that, you know, I find troubling, that I think I would like to think I would oppose that in the context in which it is happening. And yet at the same time, you have these Catholic clergy who are doing things such as translating protocols of the Elders of Zion and going on trips to Germany to tour concentration camps. In one case, I read of a Catholic priest who outright participated in committing executions. And it seems like that is something we have to take into account here, that I put it more less like, oh, this is like violence based on someone's religion, which I think just in general is something that should not be done and is abhorrent, and more political factions engaging in violence against each other, which is ugly and brutal, but also fairly expected. What I like to call things that I don't necessarily advocate, but I file under what did you think was going to happen? Yeah, you know, when... Go ahead.
I think a crucial component there is that when the entirety of Spain descended into civil war, powerful factions basically had to pick a side. Yes. And they sort of went through, they sort of sided with those who were most ideologically comfortable, like the sort of both the, however you define it, the agrarian and rural proletariat, as well as the urban proletariat, what we in modern terms call the working poor, found the leftist much more appealing. It made more sense. And the Catholic Church, which is a long and venerable and frankly quite powerful and hierarchical institution in Spain, found it easier to side with the phalangists. And it found it, and in some even more sort of disturbing fringe incidents, like, for example, it sounds like a Spanish priest touring a concentration camp. It sounds like the trappings of their sort of spontaneous fascist allies, for lack of a better word, oftentimes seeped into the temporary behavior and ideology. And it's interesting, too, because in certain places you see also like folk Catholicism, like liberation theology, is through South America, like I think, which is people have argued that was an influence on Pope Francis's view. Mm-hmm. The clergy in South America in those cases went to the leftists because their way of being was more aligned with how the leftists acted or how the leftists engaged with politics and organization. And so I think it was as again referring to war or massacre as inevitability is fundamentally callous, but I'm going to do it anyway. It was kind of I think inevitable that the Catholic Church of 1930s Spain would fall in with the phalangists and potentially also adopt the anti-Semitism,
indeed,
and the opposition to sort of more popular leftist rule.
It's really weird reading this history as someone who was raised Catholic. Not necessarily raised well, but like I said, I went through the first couple of years of your first communions and your first confessions and all that sort of thing. But then who kind of started figuring out early on in my life, there were many things about Catholicism I found very suspect. And then reading the history and learning like, oh, well, you know, like you said, you definitely have your examples of like liberation theology and really progressive Catholic movements, socialist Catholic blends and things like that. Things that I think are pretty admirable and very sympathetic, who often do end up receiving very vicious violence in their own contexts. And then, you know, as someone who grew up and, a lot of this history becomes very personal, myself being someone who eventually fell into, I guess you could say, Judaism, I guess semi-secularized version of it. I'm an atheist nowadays, but I really like ritual. Then reading about the immense amount of anti-Semitism in Spain, which is, on the one hand, it makes sense given Spanish history, but on the other hand, I'm not even sure there were very many Jews in Spain at the time. I don't really read about there being community, and I know there were, but they don't seem to be a part of the history. Like, I don't hear about, you know, Jewish communities having decisive roles. The Jewish communities I read about in the Spanish Civil War history tend to be Jews joining the international brigades and that sort of thing. And yet, there was a really obsessive, paranoid obsession with Jews on the part of the Catholic Church, the nationalists at large, that is just like, God damn it. Like, Germany at least had a significant, vast, giant population that they had to decide, like, oh, let's exterminate these, you know, dogs over here. But, like, with the Spanish, it's like, yo, they weren't even around. And of course, I think the obvious answer to that is it's because of the Judeo-Bolshevism conspiracy theory. They don't have to be around because there's communists and they're the same thing. Therefore, yes, Jews are a problem.
It's very strange. I mean, I had a friend of mine who once made a very wry remark about Schrodinger's Jew. The Jews have historically been blamed for both communism and capitalism.
It's so true.
And anti-Semitism is a very weird human sickness in its in its pure and sort of malignant expression. And what's funny, too, and this is something that kind of boggled me, is that there has been, over the past 20 years, a revival in interest and popularity in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Mm-hmm. And apparently, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion has proven remarkably popular in places where there are effectively no Jews, including Japan.
Yes, I've heard the right wing is really into it for some reason.
Yeah, and it's such a strange and bizarre trope. But I think what it comes down to is, regardless of, because in the way, anti-Semitism is not about sort of an honest understanding of Jews as human beings or as a culture under themselves. It's this obsessive need to demonize someone who is perceived as an outsider. It's that, again, it's that constant authoritarian need to construct or inflate an enemy, and say that I will protect you from that, and that therefore I create authoritarian power within myself by accumulating a cult of anger around me I can project at someone who is fundamentally harmless or marginalized.
It's very interesting also to see, to bring it back to our contemporary and future times, to see the resurgence of anti-Semitism into the mainstream, which I was, if you had asked me a year or two ago what I would have expected, I mean, obviously, anti-Semitism is never gone away, but it seems to have moved pretty far back and to the fringes for the most part. And yet, this year, it's like they've come back out. That, you know, there were accusations fairly early on against the Trump campaign. Well, there was that that campaign speech he did at like December 2015 to a Jewish organization, I don't remember which one, where he basically flat out went out there and was like, "Hey guys, I'm really good at making deals, and that's what you guys do. So let's make a deal." Just like, oh my God, yeah. Like, what is he? And then, but then from there it escalated. You know, it almost seemed like he had this sort of attitude in that, you know, I would say that American Jewry generally seems to be fairly liberal, generally speaking, and not a fan of Trump in general. And it's almost as though that he saw, like, all right, they're not playing ball, so I'm going to then full whole hog go in with the anti-Semites as well as the hardcore right-wing Zionist community who certainly are Jews, but also very conveniently believe in a lot of the same ideas as we do. It's just such a bizarre time, you know, to see these right-wing organizations, right-wing Jewish organizations, who all of a sudden are like, you know what? You know who is anti-Semitic? BDS. You know who isn't? Donald Trump and Steve Bannon. You know, it's just mind-boggling to see that happening again. And I think it's very interesting because, you know, as of time of recording, we're just days after the UN vote at the Security Council condemning the settlements in the West Bank. And you are seeing this really interesting public opinion shift, which is already occurring, that is now starting to turn the settlements in Israel into a partisan issue, which was not the case very previously. And you are also seeing American Jewish, especially the younger Jewish people, having really intense debates with themselves, with each other, with their families over, okay, we're seeing we've been talking about anti-Semitism for years. It's now getting really real in a way it wasn't before. And at the same time, you're seeing Zionism starting to adopt a lot of the same, not the anti-Semitic rhetoric, but like some of the premises that in other ideologies rationalize anti-Semitism. It's just a mind-boggling and deeply troubling time to be living in right now.
Yeah, I mean, the fondness that blatant anti-Semites like Steve Bannon have for the Israeli right creeps me out big time. And I mean, I've spoken to Jewish friends of mine. I've tried to bounce this around my, you know, sort of like Protestant headspace and try to figure out, you know, what the reason is for this, because I have no, I was clearly not, you know, raised Jewish. And so this conversation sort of predates my attempt to understand it politically and its broad machinations. But my understanding is that part of the reason, and it's a really sort of slimy, snake-like reason why people like Bannon seem to like Israel so much, and or at least advance such a patronizing kind of cynical fondness for the Israeli right, is because they're totally fine with Jews as long as they are you know, segregated in another country. I think there's this really dark kind of mantra among the wannabe sort of neo-Nazis of this current era who, you know, talk a big game on the internet, and their phrase is Aliyah or death. Meaning
Jesus
you
Christ.
Go to Israel. Isn't that horrific? It's just awful.
Oh my
but
God.
But it also
that's,
reminds me of it's terrible. And it's, I think, among the darkest, most deranged elements of the anti-Semitic far right. I think it's they just sort of see that, you know, we don't like Jews, quote unquote, as broadly defined as this anti-Semitic construct that they imagine. And they sort of ostensibly bring is sort of those old anti-Semitic ancient tropes that, you know, Jews are culturally or politically poisonous. And therefore, we just need to get them out of the country. And the more, you know, we support Israel's a state where Jews can go, we can pretend to put on a smiley face while hoping they all leave. And it's not what Trump himself is saying, but it is sort of a very weird fringe attitude, I think, among some of his darker supporters.
I think also it's what Israeli politics and Israeli society, the transformation it's currently going to as it sort of sheds its sort of, it already had shed its, you know, labor Zionist roots years ago, but now it's even shedding the remains of its, you know, liberal and like liberal democratic European sort of pretenses that they used to have. They're starting to develop into this really right wing and sometimes straight up fascist or proto-fascist ideology. And to a lot of these, you know, there are some anti-Semites who don't discriminate and just say, hey, you're all Jews, you know, fuck you. I might have to bleep that. I don't know. I said fuck. But then you have other anti-Semites who I think probably make up the majority of the alt-right movement and other related movements who they hate Jews, but specifically they hate, I guess you could call them, to borrow a Stalinist term, the rootless cosmopolitans, those who are foreign no matter what, and also inherently liberal Western and Western in a sort of liberal sort of way, not in terms of the way that they like to think of Western, but who like embrace multiculturalism and diversity and liberal ideals, which is something that I think certainly American Jewry seems to lean heavily towards, that sort of version of Jewish life, Jewish cultural life, versus Israel is moving in a very different direction.
It's very interesting you mentioned that, because there's this very smart guy I go to school with who has spent a good amount of time in Israel, and I had the privilege of speaking to about this. And he mentioned that, and this was actually during a class presentation he gave as well, that while in the West, or the West, of course, is a crude term, I use the West to refer to as sort of the European and American diplomatic bloc.
It's hard not to use the term sometimes. It just pops in. You're like, ah, damn it.
It does, yeah. But you can bleep it out, too, if you want to. But anyway, he made the mention that, as we know, the younger generations in America and Europe are more liberal, if not left-leaning. Whereas there's they're more liberal left-leaning than their elders, whereas there's a paradox in Israel where the younger generations are more right-leaning and nationalistic and less favorable to sort of the social democratic, labor-friendly principles of their grandparents, those who have been living in Israel since its founding or even before then. So it's a strange and kind of complicated situation. And it's strange, too, because on the alt-right, there are some, again, the alt-right is, as described broadly, is such a strange freak show of really odd people in terms of their spokesmen and their Twitter celebrities. But there's like, what's his name? Milo Yabadabadopoulos or whatever his name is. The guy who likes to, whenever he will basically dabble in weird anti-Semitic tropes. Like, I think he did when he had that that spat with Ben Shapiro when Ben Shapiro, who is a Orthodox Jew and very right wing, but clearly not friendly at all with the alt-right, left Breitbart, Milo, you know, whatever his name is, threw out some anti-Semitic tropes. And when people pointed out, like, dude, that's not acceptable at all. You cannot, you should not say that. He said what he basically invokes that he allegedly had like one Jewish grandparent. And he's like, well, I can't be an anti-Semite. And it is, it's so strange. And it is sort of the funny place where sort of this old ugly anti-Semitism is pervading the discourse in a way it hasn't before. But there is a strange discrimination along political lines where, for example, Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is treated with an odd amount of respect by people who might otherwise be frothing anti-Semites. And Jared Kushner, I believe, was raised an Orthodox Jew. So it's we're seeing a lot of strange, I mean, broadly speaking, America and Europe as well, a lot of ideological reshuffling and all sorts of strange pieces maneuvering themselves. Because the old, we were to refer to as sort of the post-Reaganite neoliberal order is kind of breaking down. And we're seeing sort of this very ersatz fake economic populism on the right. And inevitably, whenever the right tries to assert economic populism, the demonization of minority groups occurs. And I think that has been with an almost sort of stale predictability, part of the reason why sort of we're seeing this almost weird antiquated anti-Semitism become somehow in vogue.
Indeed. We are a little bit over an hour, I believe, now, so we should probably start to wrap this up.
Yeah, sure.
Final thoughts? Anything else we didn't talk about that you feel like spending a couple of minutes going off on?
Oh, this is something I've been crossing my mind when I was doing a little bit of research prep for this. And this is just sort of a broad aspect of leftist movements, especially leftist guerrilla movements in general. But one of the ways in which leftist movements succeed and can make them effective is, in so few words, whether or not they get along with the locals and whether or not they sort of stage indigenous armed revolt from the ground up. And there's one of the key aspects of Mao Zedong's personality cult was he was incredibly witty and snappy with aphorisms. And of course, the Great Leap Forward in the Cultural Revolution was brutal in China, but Mao was, to his credit, and even at my foreign policy school, which is very sort of, for lack of a better word, aggressively centrist in its ideology and sort of broad outlook among professors, we study the writings of Mao regarding guerrilla warfare. And Mao had this one aphorism, and it's translated from the Mandarin, I'm probably butchering it, went to the lines, something along the lines of, the people are the stream through which the minnow swims. And yes, there's another adjunct phrase to that, and the phrase goes, and this is another Maoist aphorism, if you lose land, land can be regained. If you lose people, land and people are both lost. And overwhelmingly, the place in which enduring leftist revolutionary or guerrilla movements persist is if they do well by and find the support of the common people, which allows them to organize, network, establish supply lines, etc. And that, I think, as a template, regardless of circumstance, can be used to gauge how and potentially how long a lefty movement as a militant or guerrilla organization will persist.
I think that the way that leftist movements succeed is by recruiting NPR tote bag carrying people and reforming the Democratic Party.
Oh, obviously. I mean, that's like the first step. I mean, as soon as we can get like, what's his name who does This American Life? What's like his dude's name?
Ira Glass. Is that
him? As soon as we can get Ira Glass, you know, out in the jungle with a Kalashnikov and a tote bag, I think we're pretty much set.
I want to see Keith Olbermann leading a charge of the international brigades. That's what I want to see. That I would pay some money to see that.
Oh, I'm imagining Keith Olbermann with that sort of characteristic yell expression on his face, holding up a red and black flag, charging over a hill as a bunch of idealistic, proletarian farmers, university students follow behind him with like 80s issue sniper rifles and small arms. That is how the Trump administration will be defeated.
Oh, Lord. I try to keep my my opinions in politics to a minimum on like the narrative part of this podcast. But I decided the discussions ones is the one where I can be a little snarky, you know, gotta get out of my system. Left unity, though. That's cool.
Yeah, well, it's funny, too. It's kind of cool doing this podcast with you, because among my friends, I am much more left-leaning than most of them, but you make me look like John Huntsman in comparison. So it's
Oh, good Lord. Yeah, and I'm generally pretty careful what I say when the microphone is on, so we'll discuss some real shit when I turn it off.
Yeah, well, let's look forward to it.
Oh, word. All right, well, thank you so much for being on the show, Adam. I appreciate it.
Yeah, anytime, Kenny. It was great.
Adam Pedersen maintains a blog called Napalm in the Morning, www.napalminthemorning.com. And he also writes for Current Affairs, a pretty awesome up-and-coming leftist web magazine. You can find that at www.currentaffairs.org/author/Adam Pedersen. You can also reach him on Twitter at AdamPattersonDC or contact him via email at napalmintheam@gmail.com. The Movements is a left-wing history and politics podcast. Music by the Manic Street Preachers. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Support the show at www.paypal.me/movementspodcast. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Movements Pod. Send all comments, questions, and good faith criticisms to movementspod@gmail.com. So if I can't shoot rabbits, then I can't shoot fascists.